Epilogue. The Manson murders have an aura of finality. In 2016, The Guardian marveled at how they compel us, despite the lack of any meaty mystery. There are no questions about what happened. We know pretty much exactly who did what to whom, when, and why. In a sense, that's true. The material evidence is sickeningly conclusive, and it still shocks today. But it doesn't make sense. The mystery is there. In my nearly 20 years of reporting on this case, people have asked me all the time, what do I think really happened? I hate that question more than anything. The plain answer is, I don't know. I worry that as soon as I speculate, I undermine the work I've done. In a sense, had I been more willing to fill in the blanks, I might have finished this book a lot sooner. That's not to say I haven't entertained a lot of pet theories over the years. They've fallen in and out of favor as I learned more or shifted my focus. For a while, I was convinced the victims at the Tate and LaBianca houses knew their killers in the family, that they'd been targeted. Maybe not by the girls, but by Manson and Tex Watson. It may have had something to do with a drug burn, or an unknown middleman with connections to Hollywood. Or there's the possibility that the family was caught up in a Chaos or COINTELPRO operation, goaded into violence as sheriffs, deputies, and the LAPD looked the other way, necessitating a cover-up. And there's the most far-out theory, that Manson was tied to an MK-Ultra effort to create assassins who would kill on command. It's when someone claims that I've found the truth that I get anxious. I haven't found the truth, much as I wish I could say I have. My goal isn't to say what did happen, it's to prove that the official story didn't. I've learned to accept the ambiguity. I had to, I realized, if I ever wanted to finish this audiobook. For every chapter here, there are a dozen I've left out. There's more. There's always more. But I haven't stopped trying. If there's hope anywhere, it's in the documents. I remain shocked by the state's lack of transparency. For reasons I can't understand, district attorneys, law enforcement agents, federal bureaus, and other outposts of officialdom continue to suppress their files, even as they claim they have nothing to hide. This position assumes a certain amount of complacency in the public. If the truth turns out to exist on a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, on the 3,005th page of a transcript so dry that no one has read it from start to finish, they're counting on our not caring. To get to that kernel of truth, you have to generate a paper trail of your own, of FOIA requests, public hearings, and concerned letters to your congressperson, all eventually housed in their own sleepy archives. As of this writing, the LAPD and the DA's office are still in legal battles about their unfathomable refusal to release information, a refusal that extends to the victims' families and to the defendants themselves. The latest front is a battle over the Tex Watson tapes. Soon after the murders, Watson absconded to his parents' place in Copeville, Texas. On November 30, 1969, he turned himself in for questioning after learning that two LAPD detectives were on a plane heading his way. He got a lawyer, Bill Boyd of Dallas, who sat him down to make a taped confession. This is, as far as anyone knows, the first known recorded account of the crimes. Before Bugliosi or anyone else could impose narrative order on it. It's all the more valuable because Watson hadn't even been identified as a suspect yet. He was speaking of his own accord to his lawyer, not as a man defending himself to the police. According to Boyd, Watson described the duration of his time with the family, and in chilling detail, the killing of Tate and the other victims. He was very straightforward and candid about his involvement in the crimes, Boyd told me. He also described other murders that the group committed, murders that hadn't been discovered. In 2009, Boyd agreed to let me listen to the tapes. but only with Watson's permission, which I knew he'd never get. He wouldn't go into granular detail about them, perhaps realizing that he'd already violated Watson's confidentiality. Boyd died a year after we spoke. By 2011, his law firm had gone bankrupt, and its holdings were in receivership, including the cassettes, which he'd kept in a safe in his office. A Dallas bankruptcy trustee had come into possession of the tapes, and she seemed on the verge of releasing them to me. Instead, she offered them to Patrick Sekira, the deputy district attorney in L.A. who handled Watson's parole hearings. Sekira supported my effort to get them, and he assured me he'd let me hear them. "We wouldn't even know they existed if it weren't for you," he said. Watson tried to halt their release, filing an injunction in Texas and setting off a year-long battle. The DA's office won. But since gaining custody of the recordings, they have been played for no one outside the justice system, not even the victims' families, who asked to hear them. The DA's office and the LAPD have released only minimal and at times contradictory statements about their content. Sekira told me there were no unknown homicides mentioned on them. There was nothing new at all. But if the DA's office released them to me, they'd have to release them to everyone. And they didn't want the information to be distorted by the public. Soon after, he cut off communications with me. Richard Pfeiffer, the attorney for Leslie Van Houten, wanted to hear the tapes too. What if they contained exculpatory information that could be used at parole hearings? Pfeiffer tried to get them, but to no avail. Soon the DA's office trotted out a different reason for not releasing them. There are unsolved crimes Manson family members are suspected of committing. The information in the tapes are part of the investigation of those crimes and could be used to solve them. The case reached the California Supreme Court. Pfeiffer suggested that the judge could review the tapes and make his own decision, but the DA's office did not believe it necessary for the court to arduously labor through the 326 pages of Watson's rambling musings. The court decided in the DA's favor. Since then, Leslie Van Houten has been approved for parole for the first time ever. California's governor at the time, Jerry Brown, vetoed her release on the recommendation of the DA's office. Although Pfeiffer made it clear that it was his idea to go after the tapes, the DA's had lambasted Van Houten for trying to get them, saying it was clear evidence that she still hadn't accepted full responsibility for her crimes. Pfeiffer vowed to go back to court and get the tapes, and he's pursued a number of legal avenues, all unsuccessful thus far. To this day, the DA's office is guarding them with more fervor than ever. I keep the parole hearings in my calendar, making sure to get transcripts of them as soon as they're available. At these hearings, the state tries to turn the mind-bending events of August 9, 1969 into inert history. And they're one of the only places left to hope for the truth. Whenever I tell people about my work, they want to know if I interviewed Charles Manson himself. I did, over the phone in 2000. Our first conversation, disconcertingly enough, was on Valentine's Day. Our exchanges were mediated through two of Manson's associates, Pincushion and Gray Wolf. The former, nicknamed for the frequency with which he'd been stabbed, was born Roger Dale Smith. He was Manson's guy on the inside, his prison gopher. The latter, born Craig Hammond, had been anointed Gray Wolf by Manson himself and brokered all outside access to Manson. A retiree, he'd moved to Hanford, California decades earlier just to be near the prison that housed Manson, whom he believed to possess deep insight into environmental issues. Many of Manson's latter-day followers claimed to be enchanted by his ecological ATWA philosophy: air, trees, water, animals, or all the way alive, through which he endorsed the use of a seed gun called the Savior to repopulate California's plant species. Later, Hammond was arrested for smuggling a cell phone to Manson in prison. A few years after that, when Manson had gotten engaged to a young woman named Starr, he discovered that Hammond had been sleeping with her and rechristened him Dead Rat. In 2000, when Grey Wolf set up my interview, he urged me to protect myself. "You don't know what powers are pushing against you," he said. He patched me through to Pincushion, who put on Manson himself. We would have 5 minutes to talk before the prison terminated the call automatically. "Hello, Tom," Manson said. "Hi, Charlie. How you doing?" "Oh, hanging loose, man." "Happy Valentine's Day," I said. "Yeah, same to you, man." I'd only caught Manson's interest because his handlers had told him I had information about potential perjury during the trial. Terry Melcher's. But now that I had him on the line, he wanted to talk about anything but Terry Melcher. I gave him a brief introduction to my angle for Premiere, which he dismissed as hype. He wanted me to speak to the heart. I rattled off a list of names to see if he knew them. "I don't know anyone, man," he said. "I barely know myself." Manson spoke in riddles when he spoke at all. He claimed that there was a lot of money behind the murders, and that the United States Navy held the purse strings. "I'm Vincent Bugliosi's godfather," he said. But he wasn't a snitch, so he wasn't going to give me any names. "There's a lot of people playing a lot of games, man," he said. He added, "I pitched horseshoes when I was 17. Whenever he didn't feel like answering, he'd say something like that. "I've got 5 red wheels on that truck," or, "When Reagan went to Greenland, we locked all the weather stations to the Heart Project." Our 5 minutes vanished before I even got my bearings. Hammond dialed again. If I wanted to connect with Charlie, he said, I had to show him my human side, my heart. I took a breath while Manson got back on the line. "Look it, man," he said. "See, I have no way of knowing what you're biting into." I tried again to explain. Even in Manson's more lucid moments, the only thing we saw eye to eye on was that the prosecution had played dirty. But he didn't think Melcher was the problem. He didn't say anything. He seemed to have written Melcher off. "The simplicity of the whole thing is that Terry gave his word for something," he said, "and he didn't do it. And we didn't realize that the Korean War was lost." To him, the real villain was Linda Kasabian, his lapsed follower, who'd flipped for the prosecution. She gave the souls of her children up to the devil in a sacrificial trip that came down in an agreement with the universal mind, he explained. "You just tell her that the key to Red Skelton's house is in the ventilator and it's still there, and the crypt is still there with the dogs at attention." Our time was nearly up again. Manson passed the phone back to Pincushion, who offered to write down my remaining questions and send me Manson's answers verbatim. But the next night, Grey Wolf called and said that would never happen. Manson, who was apparently much less gnomic with his friends than he'd been with me, was upset with me. He and Pincushion wouldn't talk again or send answers. Grey Wolf seemed surprised by all of it. He wasn't used to Manson taking calls from journalists, and he said that he too was still processing everything he'd heard last night, as if some of it had been news to him. I wondered if this had more to do with Pincushion, who'd made some bold claims as he'd jotted down my questions. He said Manson personally knew Mama Cass Elliot. He'd brought his girls to orgies for the Hollywood elite. He'd left a bunch of bodies out in that motherfucking desert, man. And most mystifying of all, other members of the family may have gone to the Tate house the night she was killed. I wondered if Manson had been standing next to him while he said all this, and gotten angry afterward. In 2008, I reached out to Manson again through Grey Wolf. This was after my many run-ins with Manson's former followers, many of whom were not as former as I thought. The people I'd asked about Filippo Tenorelli and other possible victims must have relayed those communications to Manson. Grey Wolf told me never to get in touch again. "People are upset with you and you're in trouble," he said. "You don't have permission to do what you're doing." He wouldn't say more. I was cut off. "And I don't know you," he added. He hung up. So concluded my dealings with Charles Manson and his inner circle. When Manson died in November 2017, the moment aroused little feeling in me. My investigation orbited him, but he mattered hardly at all to me. At some point, as a cottage industry rose up around him and he became a true crime icon, he'd been made brittle, toothless. His image had become a repository for our fears. Everyone preferred the idea of him to the reality. And in death, he was more ideal than ever. The killer hippie from the 60s. A decade that feels further removed from the present than many that occurred before it. Always willing to play the madman, he slipped too easily into our understanding of the criminal mastermind. In that rictus of his, those glinting eyes, the X carved into his forehead, we're supposed to recognize what Bugliosi famously called a metaphor for evil. But the full extent of that evil isn't in what we know about Manson. It's in what we don't know. That's what kept me going all these years, even when I was broke, even when people said I was crazy, even when I had death threats lobbed at me. As Manson said to me with an air of disgust, "The bottom line is that you want information." "Exactly," I said.